It's time to wake to sleep with the number one sleep authority, Sleep Science Today, and Sleep Better Tonight.
Welcome to another episode of Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. Today, we are talking with Dr. Justin Brooks. He's an associate professor in computer science and electrical engineering at UMBC. And we're going to be talking about sleep diaries and wearables. So, Dr. Brooks, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Andrew.
Yes. So for those of you who are listening, there is a main conference called the Sleep Conference that happens once each year, and they kind of move it around the U.S. And this is where all the sleep scientists and sleep professionals get together to share their findings and new research and new products and just anything and everything related to sleep. So, you know, there's a lot going on in the sleep industry if you come to one of these conferences to hear all the wonderful research that people are doing. So obviously, when we talk about sleep, one of the biggest areas, and probably a lot of our listeners have this issue, is insomnia. It's you know, you can't talk about sleep without talking about insomnia. So let's start off with that. Tell us your work with insomnia, and maybe even give us just some basics. What exactly is insomnia?
No, absolutely, Andrew. And I'll take a step back just to say, why is there a computer scientist professor talking to you about sleep and insomnia? My background is mostly in biomedical engineering and neuroscience. I did a combined medical degree and PhD in that biomedical engineering sort of neuroscience space, and I spent a lot of time working on the assessment of humans using non-invasive sensors, machine learning, artificial intelligence, and such. And one of the areas that we've gotten into in particular is sleep, and in particular insomnia, which is it's a really interesting disorder and phenomena where a person really reports a lack of quality in their sleep, feeling poorly rested, feeling like they didn't sleep long enough, feeling like it takes too long for them to fall asleep, these types of things. And it's an interesting condition because, you know, there's multiple ways that you can get there. One is, you know, you may have limited opportunities to sleep. Think about, you know, a shift worker or a soldier. You have just limited time to actually get to sleep. You may have a physiologic dysfunction, right? You may have a brain that's wired for less sleep, or a more active that nervous system, and therefore have, you know, a physiologic medical condition that prohibits you from sleeping well. The last bucket that I think gets overlooked quite a bit that we're most interested in is there's also a cognitive perceptive component to it, right? There's this idea that, you know, we evaluate insomnia by asking people, well, how do you feel about your sleep? Do you feel rested? Do you feel these certain things? And inherent into that question is perception, right? Is how well do I understand what's happening in my sort of internal milieu to generate these sorts of feelings? And what is interesting is that people have all types of reasons to not be good at sort of what we call interoception, that ability to sort of recognize your internal sort of state. That vary a lot, and I'm sure we can discuss a lot more. But when you think about it, then when you're asking somebody with insomnia to evaluate their sleep, you know, that perceptive component is not only sort of the diagnostic criteria that we use to say, hey, yes, you do have insomnia, but it's also the way that the person speaks to themselves about it. And if there's a misalignment there, right, if they're not perceiving themselves well, then maybe they actually don't have an underlying sort of problem that needs to be addressed with either medication or behavioral change. They need sort of a cognitive realignment, right? They need an idea to sort of be sort of recalibrated to sort of get a better understanding of themselves, and then ultimately sort of improve their functional outcome with that condition. I mean, yeah, so there's a lot of debate in that area, but that's our particular view.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't want to kind of take us off track here, but I am curious, when you were talking about, you know, your work with biomedical engineering and the concept of sleep and just how it impacts the human body and all those things, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, there's lots of situations. You mentioned shift workers, you mentioned soldiers, and, you know, I'm thinking to myself, okay, maybe you're a soldier and maybe you've got night duty. You know, you've got to be up doing something in the middle of the night. watch or maybe you're in an active campaign or something like that. I would assume on one level, that's not the best time for people to be doing things is in the middle of the night when they normally would be sleeping. But on another level, if they're fully engaged, and that now I'm thinking about like a soldier fully engaged in an operation in the middle of the night, probably they've got a bunch of adrenaline going through them, which is, you know, changing their perception. But can you talk a little bit about, because I truly don't know, and I'm curious, what happens with people? Because, you know, I wouldn't say it's the traditional insomnia of someone who's living a comfortable life and can't sleep well, but you're talking about a situation where a person's in a situation where they're not sleeping because they're, you know, concerned about their livelihood.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a great question, and sort of gets at the core of sort of that segmentation of insomnia, if you will. You know, so that bucket of things, you know, the soldier that's up at night doing nighttime operations, or the shift worker that's spent up, you know, all night, you know, at the hospital, the oil rig, wherever it is, that fits in that bucket of, you know, poor sleep, a person recognizing they have poor sleep, but sort of in factors that are somewhat external to their control, right? That's that limited opportunity to sleep. That's that limited the limited opportunity, whether that's behavioral, whether that's because, you know, you're staying up to watch the latest, you know, America's Got Talent and staying up super late to watch it, or somebody's imposing some sort of restriction on your ability to sleep. That's not something that you're going to be able to address with I'm not going to reframe your perception of your sleep. It's like, you did get crappy sleep. You're supposed to be asleep at nighttime, right? So it doesn't apply in that domain. And so that's where other technologies are being developed, where, you know, you can sense brain signals and you can give them, for example, like auditory stimulation, like a sound to help enhance slow wave sleep. You know, in those sort of conditions, you know, this idea of a sleep diary and sort of, you know, cognitive component doesn't have that much of a factor, right? That's where, you know, new technologies for sleep, medications even might be appropriate. Different types of therapy would be appropriate. But and I think that's where you see in those populations, you know, they're looking to technologies that are closed loop, that are providing that sort of, direct therapeutic effect on poor sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as you're talking about this, I'm thinking to myself about some of the clients that I work with, and this is sort of a comment for the audience in general. You know, if you're someone who's having trouble sleeping and you feel that it's insomnia, well, it may very well be. However, I've had some patients where they have insomnia, meaning they have trouble sleeping at night. But when we dig into it, we find out that the reason that they're awake at night or on edge at night is because of some traumatic event that may have happened to them. Maybe somebody attacked them in the middle of the night or something. And so we're looking at a very different type of a response, where the body is protecting itself to remain alive, you know, versus a different thing. So it's always important to figure out what's the underlying cause of this insomnia before we can even get into treating it. But those are thankfully lesser numbers of cases. And most people just report, like you said earlier, they've got trouble falling asleep or staying asleep. And some people, for me, generally, it tends to be people more elderly have a lot of problems with early morning awakenings. But anyways, so when we're looking at the traditional insomnia that most people think about when they talk about insomnia, what you've mentioned, obviously, cognitive concerns, there's behavioral issues. So what is the traditional approach today? And then let's talk about how that brings us into the tools that clinicians may use to address the patients.
Sure. And just to be clear, I'm not a clinician in the insomnia space, a sleep practitioner. You know, while I'm a licensed physician, I don't really practice. I do spend most of my time in research and sort of R&D development. So I don't want to come across as an expert sort of in the diagnosis or treatment. Just, I spent a lot of time reading about it. My understanding is that, you know, when, you know, patient shows up and says, "Hey doc, you know, I'm having some trouble sleeping," you know, they sort of get a history around that, you know, look for, like I said, again, the same buckets that we talked about before. You know, is there specifically with the physician, right? You're going to be looking at a physiologic reason for it. You know, you described what sounds like somebody who had a traumatic event is having these other issues. You know, that diagnostic pathway might lead you down to like a REM sleep behavior disorder, right? Which has its own sort of functional sort of treatment. And so I think, you know, you spend your time kind of thinking about those different buckets. And, you know, after you work up sort of an organic cause for it, which, you know, would vary based on the patient's history, then you would look at sort of other behavioral, environmental, aspects of it that might be. And so everybody's heard 1,000 times about sleep hygiene, you know, go to bed at the same time every night, and, you know, screens, blah, 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 blah. That sort of stuff gets sort of implemented. And if that doesn't work, then, you know, there's sort of cognitive behavioral therapy that's done to sort of help people think about improving the sleep hygiene piece and trying to get into a rhythm, but also trying to address sort of the vicious cycle that you get into here, where it's like, I don't feel like I'm sleeping well, and then bedtime comes and you're thinking, oh, I'm not going to get any good sleep anyway, what's the point? And sort of disrupting that cycle and helping people, you know, walk and talk through that type of that type of mental process. And so that's sort of my understanding of how, a general patient walks in the door and presents with, you know, trouble sleeping, sort of think about in those buckets and pursue, you know, workups, you know, in each one. Ideally, you know, everybody would like to get to a medical, like, oh, here we go, pin this, and then, you know, we have a treatment for it. But after that's exhausted, then you go to the more common, I think, but much broader other aspects of it.
So, you know, the cognitive behavioral part of it, that's, you know, for me as a clinician from that side, I'm not an MD, I do the behavioral side, so we use cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia all the time. And in that, we get into this issue that you have talked about a little bit here, is the perception about your sleep. We use sleep diaries, because sleep diaries help us understand what is going on with a patient. And a sleep diary is basically tracking everything about your sleep. What time did you get into bed? How long did it take to fall asleep? Did you wake up in the middle of the night? How many times? How often? You know, for how long? What time did you wake up? All sorts of things about sleep that we ask. And, you know, for me now, using that for so many years, I can look at a sleep diary and pretty much almost instantly tell you what the problem probably is. But sleep diaries themselves are interesting, because what we tell the patients, or at least what I tell the patients, and this is from my training, is when you're in bed, we don't want you looking at the clock, because that's going to just build anxiety. If you look at the clock and you see it's 4 o'clock and you're like, oh my God, I got to be up at 6 and I'm wide awake. And it builds this whole anxiety loop and then keeps you up. So we tell people not to look at the clock, but at the same time, we're asking them to track their sleep. And they're like, well, how am I going to know how long I was up, because I don't have a clock to look at? So talk to us about sleep diaries.
Sure. That's I like that story. I hadn't heard that one before. I like that, but I can see sort of the loop they go through. Yeah, sleep diaries are great. I mean, you know, sleep diaries form sort of the endpoint for how we think about sleep, at least from a functional, I guess more of a functional in terms of the person's life perspective. I mean, so the idea here is that, you know, a sleep diary will ask you several questions, like you were alluding to. What time did you get into bed? How long did you think you fell asleep? How long did it take you to fall asleep? How many times did you wake up? These types of things. And the idea, as I view it, is a way to characterize the night and of sleep through the lens of someone's sort of emotional or sort of daily experience, right? And they're critical. They're used, as you were talking about, in cognitive behavioral therapy. They're used in practices to understand, you know, whether treatments are having a certain effect. They're used in pharmaceutical companies as endpoints in FDA regulated trials. So they're, you know, the sort of standard by which we assess the experience of sleep from the human perspective. And, you know, a lot of them are administered, you know, the traditional ones are administered sort of as a journal, right? So it's like a notebook with things that you write, and it's still done quite a bit now. And now, of course, we do have more electronic versions that are available on mobile apps, on websites and things. But generally, the idea of this whole of the of the sleep diaries to characterize, you know, the patient's experience of sleep and you know, sort of our, that's of critical importance, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I definitely want to talk about how that is changing as we get into this telehealth
sure,
style of medicine that we're in. But before we do that, let me stop and take our first break, and we'll come back, and then let's talk about how that framework is changing with telehealth and everything else. So we'll be right back in just a minute on Sleep Science Today.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today.
All right. Welcome back to Sleep Science Today. We're talking with Dr. Justin Brooks, and we were just talking about sleep diaries. And, you know, you were saying that normally one of the ways that people do a sleep diary is they literally take a piece of paper and they write down certain information, which is important and helpful. But now we are in this new world of telehealth and telemedicine. And how are people adapting to that? What's going on with sleep diaries in terms of the current versions?
Sure. Well, I will say, you know, based on some conversations we've had recently, you know, there's a lot of people that are still using the paper and pencil sleep diaries. It happens quite a bit more than we'd normally expect. And one of the limitations of that, of course, is that, you know, not everybody's great about filling out their diary as soon as they get up in the morning. And so what ends up happening is that, you know, your therapist or your doc says, hey, you know, take your diary for 2 weeks. You wait until the 13th day right before you go back to the clinic and fill it all out in the waiting room or in the parking lot with all your sleep diaries. You know, how good is this data at that point? And, you know, that's an extreme, but, you know, things like that happen quite a bit. And then so that has prompted a move towards electronic diaries. And there's several apps out there that have different versions of a sleep diary that offer different features. And that is more helpful in terms of compliance, you know, getting better quality data because the person is filling it out closer to the sleep event rather than, you know, more distant from it. So I think, you know, certainly over time that move is happening. And a lot of the electronic ones are addressing issues with the existing sort of paper thing, but like I said, the paper sort of paper and pencil sleep diary is still quite prevalent, and even in clinical trials, I've seen it done in clinical trials before, right? So,
mm-hmm. Well, so you know, for me, my practice is entirely telehealth, so the paper, you know, doesn't work very well for me, and also, like you said, the drawbacks of people filling out a week's worth of data, you know, just before they walk into the waiting room because they realize they hadn't filled out their diary, the data is probably not going to be very accurate. With the electronic diaries, you know, I think some of the pros are that if the person can remember to fill it out each morning, which is the hardest part. It kind of walks them through. It asks the question and it makes it easy for them to fill in the answer exactly as they need. And because it's telehealth, they can send it to me and I can get all that data, you know, just electronically, which makes it really easy for me to be able to then look at it. But there's also some challenges. We haven't moved as far forward as many of us would like with the sleep diaries. There's still some challenges. So what is it that you're working on specifically as relates to the sleep diaries?
Sure. So we're trying to address, you know, sort of two pain points. The paper one I sort of expressed pretty clearly in terms of, you know, why that's not the ideal solution. And that did prompt, you know, the evolution of electronic diaries. But the current sort of electronic diary, the way it's done now is very fragmented. So, you know, a given practice that addresses that sees sleep patients are going to see a variety of different sleep patients. They're going to see people with insomnia, sleep apnea, a number of different conditions, right? They're also going to have different styles, different approaches to doing that. And so what happens is you as a clinician or you as a researcher or even you as a clinical trial, you know, CRO, is looking for you buy a fit for purpose specific sleep diary for whatever it is, you know, that sort of narrow piece of what you want. So for example, you know, if you're in an office and you buy, you know, sort of in the insomnia package. So all of your questions are about insomnia. There's no room for asking about OSA or diabetes or medications or your shift work or something like that. If you wanted something like that, then you'd have to go get another diary and pay for that sort of separately. What we're trying to do is consolidate that nuance, you know, the sort of the nuanced diary, the nuanced piece into one sort of platform so that you as a clinic, you as a pharmaceutical company, whatever it is, you say, hey, look, you know, these are the patients we're studying for this period of time. We want these questions, make it quick, customizable, and then, you know, quick to be deployed and bring that data in. And then we also do, you know, just like you were mentioning before, in terms of getting patients to fill it out on a daily basis, we send notifications and that sort of thing too, to help compliance. And then some of our later projects move beyond sort of that customization piece, but also integrating a lot of the commercially available wearables, right? So people are using Oura Rings, they're using, you know, the Google Pixels, they're using Apple Watches, bringing those into that same sort of diary platform so that, you know, they can compare themselves or, you know, for research protocols or for clinicians, we can put those things together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I definitely want to, you know, dive in more into the wearables, but before we do that, as we're talking about the diary itself. So the customizable opportunities that you're creating with the sleep diaries, in order for the actual patient to fill that out, does yours kind of operate through an app, or how does a patient gain access?
Right. So the way it works is the patient would effectively scan a QR code, do a very quick sign in. Then they have an account that would be affiliated with, you know, the provider that wants them to do it. So you get, you know, one of your patients comes in, you have flyers available at your office, or even you said you're a complete telehealth. You can email them a link. They put in their email address. They're in our system. On the phones, we have a small app, but it leads to a web application. So it's cross-platform, desktop, and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It also provides a provider view on the back end so that you as a provider can look at cohorts of patients, look at their metrics, look at compliance, send notifications, that sort of thing as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, yeah. So in a traditional sense, let's assume we have a patient, they don't own a wearable, they don't have a wearable, they're just filling out the diary. How good is that data?
Our experience with the data has been great because you can control a lot of it is because you can control the notifications and the compliance. So when we look at people that are in our system, I mean, generally speaking, most of them fill in their diary for that night's worth of data within the first 6 to 8 hours, which is pretty phenomenal being able to control that. So from that perspective, we think that it's quite good. I mean, at least in terms of capturing sort of temporal recency effects, the right experiment to test that out would probably require a different design. But I think, you know, in terms of if we say that the quality of the data is better closer to the sleep event, then, you know, I think we're there in terms of, you know, comparing it to something else like PSG or another type of maybe a paper diary. I'm not sure that really answers the question as well, but that could be done. But in terms of the quality of the data, I think it's very high quality because of the recency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, one of the issues that I deal with all the time, and this now goes back to my training and all the literature that I read related to what I'm doing, there's always that question. It's like, well, if we have the ability to perfectly track exactly what time this happened and exactly what that time happened, don't we want to do that? And in my training, it's always like we're really more interested in the individual's perception of their sleep. How long did they feel it took them to fall asleep? How long did they feel they were up in the middle of the night versus the actual, you know, true what it shows on the clock? Because sleep being such a behavioral type of process, you know, the perception matters a lot, because that leads to things from a cognitive perspective that can then lead to continued anxiety, which leads to continued insomnia and all sorts of issues. So oftentimes I run into the issue with patients who say, well, it feels like this and it feels like that, and I feel like I got good sleep. But then I looked at my Apple Watch, for example, and it tells me that I, you know, was up all these times. I don't remember being up, but it tells me all this. So I must have had terrible sleep, even though they're reporting they feel they had good sleep. So, you know, I can understand if we're now talking about a research study, now the data has a different purpose. But, you know, have you run into that type of issue at all?
Yeah. So we have, in fact, we published a paper on it, in 2024, and we're working on the next one. Actually, right now we're working on the follow-up study. It depends who that gets, who that feedback is given to see that effect. And it's really quite interesting. People who generally sleep well, and let's just say that means that they don't have insomnia by some rough criteria, ISI scores, you know, something like that, right? If you show them some piece of information, like you were mentioning, like they look at their Apple Watch or whatever it is, and then ask them the same question, right? If you say, you know, how long did it take you to fall asleep? Their estimate of that time that it took them to fall asleep or how long they fell asleep gets more variable. They start to lose confidence in their perception, in the sense, but quite frankly, what is literally true, I mean, there's, you know, still some unpacking to do here, is that their variability in what they report gets much wider. Because if we look at it in comparison to what they did what they told us about their sleep when we didn't show them any information, it was a much narrower, you know, sort of like 10 minutes every night kind of thing, versus like now reporting 7 minutes, you know, 11 minutes, 12, 8, 7, right? So that's the effect that we saw, and that closely tracks what the device is sort of reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, in patients with insomnia, again, with this general definition, we use ISI scores and a couple of other things to say these people had insomnia. That effect doesn't happen. You don't see that increase very. In fact, it becomes a little bit narrower. It becomes a little bit more precise. And so what that means from a measurement perspective is interesting, right? Because if you have someone with insomnia, you can start to think about and start to track these parameters, this idea of this variability, and you can sort of begin to unpack sort of cognitive signals downstream from that. But what that means from a practical perspective is that, and I'm sure we'll get into this in a little bit, is that if you were to design that as an inventor, as something that you were interested in doing or controlling, it's important for the clinician to understand, or the therapist, whoever it is, to understand that, you know, you are playing with, you know, sort of cognitive switches here, right? That thing that you mentioned, that is sort of the beginning at the outset of this, the question of, like, you know, I had somebody that felt like they slept fine, they look at their watch and now they think they slept terribly. You know, you don't necessarily want that. And there are conditions where you would want that. There are conditions where, like, it's, hey, no, you really need to understand that wasn't good sleep, you know. But by and large, for the, you know, sort of general flavor of patient we're talking about, we don't want that to happen. But these are things that have to be controlled. And so there are ways to start to do that, you know, sort of in the beginning, and sort of, you know, look at where people are sort of in that discrepancy. Because the other side happens too. There are many, many times where people will come and say, I slept terrible, this was awful. But then you look at their wearable device, their PSG, whatever it is, and it's like, this looks like the deepest sleep I've seen in a really long time, you know.
Right. Which is really interesting, to show that, you know, because we are human, you know, we can have that discrepancy between what we feel and what we believe versus what the actual data and facts are.
Right.
But that's also something that's important to think about when we're talking about treating someone who's feeling or not getting good sleep, or feeling they're not getting good sleep.
Absolutely.
So let's take our second break here. And when we come back, I want to dive in a little bit deeper into the wearable discussion. So we'll be back in just a minute on Sleep Science Today.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good. conversation that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
All right. Thanks for joining us back after the break. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. This is Sleep Science Today. We're talking with Dr. Justin Brooks. We were just starting to talk more about wearables. So let me start off with this question. When you talk with sleep researchers, for example, they have something called actigraphy. And actigraphy uses wearables in a way. So why don't we start off with that, which is, what is the difference between the type of wearable that's used for actigraphy in research versus the consumer Apple Watch or Garmin or, you know, Fitbit or whatever the person may buy?
Sure. So actigraphy refers to generally a wrist worn, but it can be other limbs, sensor that contains it, that has an accelerometer in it. Some of them have more than an accelerometer. They have inertial measurement units. They have the magnetometers and gyroscopes on them. But generally speaking, it's an accelerometer. And what the actigraph is doing is measuring the movement of that limb actually over the course of a day to find periods of time where rest versus awake, and is really used most specifically, I believe, for circadian sort of research in terms of understanding activity levels, right? That's what it's a question of activity. It sort of got moved and morphed into sort of the sleep domain of in terms of understanding when people were laying down and may or may not have been asleep, but it was never intended as something that was like an arbiter of definitive onset and offset of sleep. I mean, just the premise of it basically is, can I, by how your arm is moving, know if you're asleep or not? And I mean, obviously you can't do that, right? There's just not enough data in that one signal of your arm moving or leg, whatever it is, to be able to do that. But we've done, there's a lot of advanced stuff that's been done with that. You know, a lot of research, you know, they've done great studies where, you know, you take that actigraph signal, measure it against the EEG and try to figure out. So we've gotten somewhere with that signal. What, you know, the consumer wearables that we were talking about before, so that you bring up the Fitbits and the Apple Watches, certainly have that sensor and sort of those base models of understanding of activity, but they've also added a lot of other sensors on top of that. So they get measures of pulse rate, right? So they can, you know, being on the wrist, they get measures of your pulse rate. Some of them include galvanic skin response or electrodermal activity, which is sort of the conductivity of the skin, which is another autonomic type signal, and several others as well. And so they can take all of that data and try to do better estimates of your sleep time. You know, they've also built up their own big models based on a lot of other sleep studies and things too that they embed on those devices. And not to mention all the other cool things that these smart devices do for you nowadays, right? You get your text messages and all that sort of stuff. There. So that's sort of the evolution of where we are with sleep wearables. I mean, I think it's been interesting having been in the sleep space for a long time. You know, for a long time, actigraphy, and everyone was really poo-pooing a lot of consumer wearables, saying that they're not accurate and all these sorts of things. But quite frankly, as you know, more data has become available, and the models get better and better, they're fairly coarse estimates of sleep generally. I mean, and sort of on average. I mean, there's certainly populations where they're going to work better versus not. But generally speaking, you know, I think it's generally well accepted now that they're coarse measures of sleep. Mm-hmm. Coarse mm-hmm. measures of sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's certainly something that is the use of such devices is growing. I don't know what the numbers are, but I can imagine exponentially over time. The flip side of that, though, is I work with some patients who rely very heavily on their, they'll tie their Apple Watch to an app. So now they have two different things that are really kind of tracking everything. And sometimes they get what we call orthosomnia, which is they're so reliant upon trying to achieve that perfect sleep score, whatever the individual company decides is a sleep score, that they get such anxiety that they end up with insomnia. And so, you know, working with patients like that, the first rule for me is you are not allowed to use your wearable and you are not allowed to use your app. And pretty much within the first couple of days, their sleep turns around and they start to move back to a normal sleep. Have you dealt with that?
Yeah, that's a huge issue. We definitely have a society where everybody's driven to these like sensors and screens and, you know, data and all that sort of stuff. It's easy, sort of an attention seek, and then does, you know, in another way, sort of get back to that cycle where you start getting anxious about your sleep, looking for the numbers, and then it goes on and on and on. I think that is a real concern. I think, you know, the way that I think about what we're doing is that it wouldn't be a long-term thing. It would be something that you would do for a month, you know, where you're playing with showing people information, not forcing them to making them complete the diary with the data to do that sort of reconciliation as a temporary sort of measure, just to sort of recalibrate. In fact, our data that we'll be publishing soon show that when you actually take the device away, like that sleep, just what you said, their sleep like maintains sort of a much better level than actually when you give the device back. So I don't think that, you know, I don't think this idea of like wearing a device every day to know your readiness for the next day, like it makes a whole lot of sense. You know, I think that if you've got a problem, you're not feeling good, you don't feel like something's wrong with your sleep, I think there's a targeted utility in using wearable for some period of time to sort of anchor sort of an estimate of where you are and compare that to your perception. And then that's sort of it. That's not to say they're not great for, I mean, I use mine for running, for working out, for everything else that I do with it. I don't wear it, you know, when I'm sleeping generally, because I just like to sleep comfortably and I'm by myself, but, you know.
So, yeah. So have you done any studies or are you aware of any studies that have looked at, I'm imagining someone wearing a wearable, but not looking at the data, and then reporting their own perceptions of their sleep. And I'm wondering how closely or not does that match up, the perceptions versus what the wearable says?
Sure, sure. Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, we have looked at that. And in fact, it builds upon, you know, a lot of other work from other great scientists too that have, you know, tried to look at that question of, you know, perception versus what can be measured. You know, I'll start off by saying that, you know, perception has its own problems, right? We have biases that, you know, you ask a soldier, you know, how well do you sleep? Depending on their motivation, they say, yeah, I slept great, because they want to go. They want to go to whatever job it is. Mm-hmm. You might not think about the, you know, somebody's asking you, you might not think about it. You might just check straight down the middle, you know, or put some sort of standard. So there's reasons why perception isn't always great. But the same is true for a wearable. These wearables, even our best measurement of sleep, polysomnography, is like a bunch of brain sensors and breathing stuff, is good, but it's not like we don't have a really concrete definition or always a great way to measure sleep itself, right? So my point is that our assessment of the phenomena of sleep, even with the best sensors and technologies that we have, is coarse at best and has limitations as well, right? And so you've got these two imperfect things of sleep. You've got this person's perception and, you know, sort of a device. Mathematically, there is a principle that if you have two sort of noisy sensors, if you think about a human as a sensor sensing their own sleep and the device, and you average those two things together, you come up with a better underlying estimate of the true phenomena. And so that is what we've been trying to do. That's what we did in our first study that you mentioned, and we did in our follow-up study in patients with insomnia. And you do see very interesting patterns there. So directly to that question, there are people who have a huge gap on either side, right? Where they say this, the device says this, or it's the other way around, right? You know, some big, big gap. Some people are much closer when they don't see their data, when you say, you can't look at the data, just tell me what you think, and then you compare it to their actual data, it looks like that. The interesting thing happens then when you actually show them the data. Some people who had big gaps like this now come back down like this. Some people estimate only halfway. Some people don't change at all. But what's most interesting is when you do that in patients that have insomnia, what we see is that their perception of the insomnia improves, being anchored to something that is more, let's just let, something anchored, anchoring them to something, anchoring them to a measurement, improves their perception of sleep. Because if you just said, not to get too far into the data, but basically we asked them to fill out total sleep time and sleep onset latency because we could get those estimates from the device. Right. So those are the questions we asked them. At the end of the study, we asked them, you know, we reperformed the insomnia severity index, the ISI, which has some questions about generally how long those things happen, but aren't the same questions. They improved on that measure of insomnia, the ISI, despite having never had, you know, had questions or anything about that, just being forced to reconcile what a device was saying about their sleep versus not. And then people with insomnia were some of those that had the biggest discrepancy between what we could measure and what they were reporting. So we think that closing that gap really does help quite a bit.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
And I assume there's probably also an element to the fact of just tracking period, whether yeah. you're doing it on a paper diary or, you know, electronically, actually paying attention and looking at what's happening gives you that reason to be better and more accurate about what's happening. So
that's right. That's right.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting area. So so let me ask you this, because we have about a minute left here, maybe a minute and a half or so. What do you see in the future? Where are things going in this area?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we're at a moment where, you know, mental health is a huge issue. Everyone's feeling pressure and burnout and stress. And I think people are looking for ways to improve that condition. I think one of the natural places people look is sleep, but also happens to be sort of a black box in a lot of ways too. And I think we are getting to a point now where we are, with all the different technological solutions and abilities that we have, looking to try to consolidate those and really address sort of the experiential component of sleep. And I think everybody's doing it. You see the devices are coming up with their sleep diaries, their sleep scores, their readiness scores, and, you know, and again, that's really, if you think about it, that is treating that cognitive, that perceptive, that experiential sort of point. I think physicians and therapists are doing the same things too, and trying to look at that. I mean, I think, you know, we've spent a lot of time working on behavioral, environmental, and, you know, as you know, changing people's behavior is really difficult. But sometimes changing their perception isn't as much. And if you do so sort of in the right way and you know, with some anchoring, with some sort of credibility, I think, you know, I think that's where we're moving. And I think you'll see technology sort of moving towards that, you know, especially with artificial intelligence that can provide a lot of a lot of assistance with that. Again, needs to be highly supervised. I mean, I use AI to some extent, but I'm by no means a laissez-faire kind of let it go do things. But right. I think there's a lot of them there.
Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, this has been a very enlightening conversation. I appreciate it. I'm sure the audience has learned a lot about what they can expect just in their own lives and how this impacts them. So this has been Dr. Justin Brooks on Sleep Science Today. Thank you all for listening. We have new episodes coming out each week. You can always visit us at www.sleepsciencetoday.com. And you'll find our podcast as well as the link for the YouTube video. So if you want to watch the episode, you can watch it there. Dr. Brooks, thank you so much for your time.
No problem. Thanks, Andrew. Take care.
All right.
You have been listening to Sleep Science Today, your number one sleep authority.